Good morning. First of all, I would like to just thank all of you who held up my family and my father in prayer over the last few years as he was struggling with various health issues, and especially in the last month as we've, as a family, have had to mourn his passing. And it just confirms to me what a wonderful and loving church body that we have here. So thank you so much. So with that being said, let us go ahead and pray. O Lord, in times past you have spoken to us through the prophets, but in these last days have spoken to us through your Son, Jesus Christ. O Lord, now may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be pleasing unto you, O Lord. In Christ's name, amen. We're going to be in the book of Habakkuk this morning. And for those of you who have not read the book of Habakkuk, it is located in the back of the Old Testament, in the portion that we refer to as the Minor Prophets. They're called the Minor Prophets because they are shorter books, not because there's anything minor about the importance or the message of these prophets. So we're going to be in Habakkuk chapter 3. But before we actually get into the text, please allow me the opportunity to set the pieces on the table and to provide some context for what we're going to be talking about today. So if you could just step with me into the Wayback Machine and walk back to the time of Samuel. Samuel was the last judge of Israel, and the people came to Samuel and they said to him, "Samuel, you're getting old, and your sons are not following in your ways. So we want you to give us a king." Well, Samuel chides them and he says, "Well, if I give you a king, he's going to take your stuff. He's going to take your money, the fruit of your labor. He's going to take your lands. He's even going to take your sons and daughters. They'll be serving in his army or serving as servants in his palace." But as we have read through the Old Testament, particularly in the time of Moses, Israelites can be a stiff-necked people, a bit stubborn, and they said, "We still want a king." So Samuel anoints Saul to be king of Israel. Saul turns out to be a disappointment. And so the Lord rejects Saul as king. And remember what Samuel said to them. He said, "You're going to cry out because of the things that these kings are going to do to you, but the Lord is not going to be listening to you." So Saul is rejected as king, and David is anointed as king. And David's considered to be a pretty good king, although he had his faults. But the good thing about David is, even in the midst of his faults, he still had a heart for God. He was named as a king after God's own heart, a man after God's own heart. And God made a promise to David. He said that your line shall rule forever. He made that covenant. There'll always be a king in Israel. That covenant with David, that promise that he made. Well, David passes, and Solomon comes up as the successor. Solomon is, he starts out really well, but Solomon collected wives like some men collect baseball cards. And so he was listening to the voices of all these wives. He was getting in surround sound, saying, "You know, build us an altar to our God." I mean, Solomon had already built the temple of the Lord. He had built up the palace. He had built up the walls of Jerusalem. And now he's just listening to his wives. And so he passes, and his son Rehoboam takes over. Rehoboam wasn't exactly a chip off the old block either. Rehoboam takes over, and the people come to Rehoboam and they say, "Rehoboam, we worked really hard under Solomon. It's time for some rest. We want rest." Rehoboam says, "Check with me tomorrow." He goes and he talks to his advisors that were King Solomon's advisors, and they advise him, "Yeah, give him rest. They've earned it. They deserve it. A wise king would give them rest." Well, he also talked to his friends, and his friends said, no, don't do that. Well, he comes back the next day and he tells them, says, "You thought that my dad was harsh? Hold my beer." And so the nation was divided into the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And I have a slide here to kind of show you how things progressed with this divided kingdom. Now, don't pay attention to all of the different names there, but I want you to take a look at the colors. The red were the kings that did evil in the sight of the Lord. The green were the kings that did good in the sight of the Lord. They were pleasing to God. And over on the right, you see the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom. And we have king after king after king after king. Not just one dynasty, but like I think there were four dynasties in the northern kingdom. Every one of them did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Till finally God said, enough is enough. He raises up the Assyrians. The Assyrians come and obliterate the northern kingdom. They take the people captive. They're gone. We have no idea what happened to those 10 tribes. In the southern kingdom, things were a little bit better. Not perfect, but a little bit better. You could see we have this, like this yo-yo, right? We have a couple of good bad kings, and then we have God raising up a couple of good kings who lead the people in revival. Then they go back into the old ways, worshiping the Baals. And then he raises up some more good kings, and we go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. The last good king we have is King Josiah. He has now passed from the scene. His son Jehoiakim is now king in Israel. I mean, Judah, excuse me, king of Judah. And so here is where we find the prophet Habakkuk. Things are not good. There is evil in the land. And so he's praying to the Lord, and we could tell by the tone of his prayer, he probably didn't pray this just once. This was like coming to God over and over and over again. How long, O Lord? How long? How long are we going to see violence and injustice and the worship of idols? You're a good God. You're a righteous God. You're a holy God. This just doesn't jive with who you are. Do something, Lord. And so God answers him and he says, yeah, I'm going to do something. I've raised up the Chaldeans, the Chaldeans. You may know them as Babylon. I have raised them up and they are going to be my instrument of justice against Judah. I will use them to chide and discipline my people. Now imagine you're Habakkuk right now. You're thinking, you know, I want God to do something, and he says, yeah, I'm going to do something. I've raised up the Chaldeans. Remember what happened to the northern kingdom with Assyria? That's probably what's going through his head. And he's saying, Lord, it doesn't make sense. I don't understand this. Because, you see, these Chaldeans, they are wicked and evil. They're worse than we are. How could you use such a wicked and evil people to bring justice to your people? And God says, it's okay. Just chill. All right? Because these people, these Babylonians, these Chaldeans, I'm going to judge them too. Chapter 2, he gets in there and he starts talking about five woes against Babylon. He says, they trust in their own strength. They trust in their might. But the righteous, they shall live by their faith. And so it is in here that we get to chapter 3. He says, God, do something. God says, I'm going to do something. I'm going to use the Babylonians as my instrument of justice. Habakkuk says, I don't understand it. They're more wicked. He says, it's okay. I'm going to judge them too. And now we come to chapter 3 where he gives his prayer written in the form of a psalm to conclude his dialogue with God. So, chapter 3, verse 1, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigionoth. O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His splendor covers the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea, when you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. Selah. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and the moon stood still in their place. At the light of your arrows they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. Selah. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. I hear, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herds in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. To the choir master with stringed instruments. So again, let's get the first question out of the way that I know you're all asking. What is a Shigionoth? And let me tell you, I don't know. There are several different opinions about it, but many agree that it is probably some form of stringed instrument, some form of musical instrument, as this is a psalm. But I want to talk about the four elements of Habakkuk's prayer here. His request. What is it that he is requesting of God? His remembrance. What is he focused on? What is he thinking about? His reality. What is he experiencing? And his response. What is he respond? How is he responding to his circumstances and his situation? So let's look at his request. He says, O Lord, I have heard the report of you and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. He approaches humbly. He stops looking at Judah and Babylon and focuses his eyes and his heart on the greatness and holiness of God, in which all else fades into insignificance. He's not looking at his circumstances anymore. He is looking at the Lord. His circumstances haven't changed, but he changes. He's looking to the promises of God. God didn't give him an explanation. He gave him a revelation. He didn't explain what he's doing or why. He just said, this is it. This is my plan. Didn't give him an explanation. But he stops asking that question. Notice what he didn't pray for. He didn't pray for deliverance. He did not pray for personal escape or for God to spare Judah or even to defeat the Chaldeans and the sparing of Jerusalem. But he says, Lord, in the midst of years, revive it. In the midst of years, make it known. Lord, do your work. Do your work. Whatever it is that you have planned, I know you're holy, I know you're righteous, I know you're good, I know your promises. do what you said you're going to do. And his expectations have changed. Take a look back at that slide for a minute here. Look at that pattern that we see here in Judah. A couple bad, and then God brings a revival, raises up a new king. Then things get bad again. God brings a revival, raises up a new king that will bring the people into righteousness. Things go bad again. God brings a revival. What do you think Habakkuk was expecting? He was expecting a revival, raise up a new king that will lead us into righteousness, that everything would be fine if we could just get our guy in. But that's not what God had planned, because the hearts of the people were still idolatrous. So it didn't matter that you had a righteous king, because as soon as the king's gone, they're going right back to their old ways. But God has a different plan. He needed to purge idolatry from his people. And so he brings in the Babylonians. God controls history. He's following a divine plan, and history follows that divine timetable. History is bound up in God's kingdom. God is the Lord of history. He controls it. He accomplishes his purpose in history for those who are his own. He is sovereign. He's in control. And he has a plan. And we see this kind of prayer in the New Testament, right? This prayer in the New Testament from Jesus himself. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Isn't that what we should be praying? Not telling God how to do his job, but just to simply say, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Whatever you got planned, Lord, I'm still here. I'm still worshiping you. I'm still following you. And then notice this powerful statement he makes in his request. In wrath, remember mercy. Isn't that the way he always does it, though? Throughout history, salvation and judgment go hand in hand. We look at Eden as Adam and Eve are kicked out of the garden in God's wrath. What does he do? He remembers mercy and the promise of the seed of the woman who will crush the serpent's head. As the rains came down and the floods went up and God's wrath was poured out upon mankind, there was an ark of God's mercy preserving Noah and his family. As the fire and brimstone fell upon Sodom and Gomorrah in judgment for their sin, what did he do? He rescued Lot, showing mercy. At Passover, as the Lord slew the firstborn in all of Egypt, he remembered mercy. When he saw the blood, he passed over Israel, showing mercy to Israel. As the walls fell in Jericho and the people of Jericho were slaughtered, Rahab was spared. In wrath, God remembers mercy. And how much more on the cross of Christ, as the full wrath of God was poured out upon his son, Jesus Christ, that we receive mercy from the Lord because of his infinite sacrifice in our behalf. And so, God, Lord, in wrath, remember mercy. What a powerful part of this prayer. A reminder that mercy and judgment go hand in hand. So we come to the next portion of the passage with his remembrance. And Habakkuk is speaking in poetic and not the most obvious of terms, but he's recalling Israel's past experience as a means of anticipating God's intervention in the future. Theologians have a fancy term for this kind of language. It's called a theophany, a vision of God. And that is exactly what Habakkuk is remembering here, a vision of God. So let's kind of look at it a little bit. He says, God came from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens and the earth was full of his praise. A reference to God on Mount Sinai as he gave the law to his people. And then he talks about his brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand and there he veiled his power. You remember Exodus 34? As Moses had received the law the second time and he was coming down from the mountain, what does it say about him? His face shone and rays of light were coming from him, and he had to veil his face lest people were confronted with the actual glory of God that they could not endure. God's showing his glory, and he had to veil his power because it was so magnificent. Before him went pestilence and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. Everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. He's speaking about God delivering his people out of Egypt and the plagues that fell upon Egyptians. And he's using some dynamic poetic imagery to describe Israel's march through the wilderness as they follow the Lord into the promised land and claim their inheritance. He's remembering his God and who he is. And then he switches even here from the third person to the second person. He's saying, you God, was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers or your indignation against the sea when you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. In other words, his bow is ready. It's there. It's a picture of an archer whose bow is right out of the sheath, like a holster. God has his bow bared for whatever the enemy brings. God is ready. The mountain saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their place at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. Here we're seeing a description of the victory of Deborah and Barak over Sisera, when a sudden rainstorm turned their battlefield into a swamp and leaves the enemy's chariots completely useless. In verse 11, we have the famous miracle of Joshua when the day was prolonged so Joshua would have more time for a total victory, leading his army. God marched through Canaan like a farmer, threshing grain, and his people claimed their inheritance. And this part's cool. This part's cool. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. God is faithful to his anointed one. God made promises to David. He made promises to Abraham. He made promises to David. Do you think those promises are gone? These are promises from God. They are steadfast and sure. And sometimes we don't understand how those promises are fulfilled. How do you think they were thinking, right? How do you think they were thinking? That the reign of David, his line, will continue on forever, right? We have that promise. But this is mind-blowing, okay? Think back a few weeks ago when Pastor Dave was speaking about the prophet Isaiah and the messianic prophecies that came from there. Isaiah, who prophesied 50 to 100 years before Habakkuk and Jeremiah, before the even thought of Babylon was in the mind of the people. And he talked about the Messiah as a shoot from the stump of Jesse. That's mind-blowing. Not a branch from the tree, but a shoot from the stump. As if he's already saying, I got to cut that tree down. I got to cut that tree down, but I haven't forgotten my promise. That shoot from the stump of Jesse, the Messiah will come, and I will keep my promises. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of the warriors, his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. O. Palmer Robertson writes in his commentary that often God's people find themselves severely disturbed because they see no visible power as strong as their enemies. But the prophecy of Habakkuk encourages the faithful to assume a strange perspective. They must look at the strength of the enemy as the very source of their own protection. The stronger the enemy, the more sure its own self-destruction. For as God sovereignly raises up powers and brings them down again, he turns the strength of the enemy against itself. Haman hangs on his own gallows. Daniel's adversaries perish in the very den of lions to which they had cast him. He who digs a pit to entrap the righteous falls into the same ditch that he has made. God will use the strength of the Babylonians against them. You have nothing to fear. You trample the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. As if to say that nothing can stop God, not even the sea itself. God wants to march right through the sea, and he can do it. He's got a powerful God, and not for a minute does he lessen his concept of God. And all of this to say what? When we pray so many times, we're so focused on figuring out how God's going to answer and kind of telling God, this is the way you answer my prayer. Don't we? You know, we have the prosperity preachers say, I'm going to believe God for a car. I'm going to believe God for a job. I'm going to believe God for this miracle. But that's not how living by faith is. God is not, doesn't want you to tell him how to answer your prayer, because you're not supposed to pray for a specific outcome, but rest in knowing on who God is and trusting him that he's got everything in control. All things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purposes. So, not focusing on how God's going to answer it, just knowing who he is and that he will answer it. And he will answer it for my good, whether I see it or not. All right? We have that passage in 2 Timothy from the Apostle Paul where he says, I know the one whom I have put my trust in, and I am sure that he is able to protect what I have put into his care until that day. That is a powerful prayer, because it says, I trust him, and he will answer it his way, and that's okay. So we've seen his request, Lord, do your work. We've seen his remembrance, I know who God is. But what is his reality? What is he experiencing right here? Hear his words. He says, I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound and rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. He's scared. He knows what God's going to do because God showed him. He knows who God is. His theology is right. But he's still scared. The answers are not enough. The title of my sermon today, When Answers Aren't Enough, because that's exactly what it is for Habakkuk right now. He's got the right theology. He knows who God is. He knows what God's going to do. But what does he say? I'm scared, God. If I could channel my inner Uber geek here for a minute. For all those Trekkies in the audience, in the congregation this morning, God did not create Vulcans. He did not create emotionless, logical beings who don't get scared, who don't get sad, who don't get depressed. He created us as emotional beings. And he didn't create Stepford wives either, who always have a smile on their face and are happy all the time. This idea that if you're a Christian, the only thing that you should experience is joy and happiness, it's not true. It doesn't ring with our reality. And it doesn't ring with Habakkuk's reality here either. I mean, think of Elijah. Elijah was confronting the priests of Baal, and he poured the water on, and he saw the great miracle of God answering by fire and consuming the sacrifice, the altar, and even the priests themselves. And then what? He had the experience. He saw God. He knew who God was. And he was still scared because Jezebel was coming for him. But God took care of him during that time. Now, he didn't let him stay in the fear. But he used that time to reassure him and acknowledge that he was afraid. And it was okay to be afraid. And think of Job. Poor Job. He had his children slaughtered, his wealth robbed and stripped of his health and afflicted with boils and sores. It was not pleasant for Job. And what did he say? Cursed be the day of my birth. He was sad. He was depressed. He was afraid. So even Jesus himself at the tomb of Lazarus says that Jesus wept. It's okay because Jesus, yes, he was fully God, but he was also fully human at the same time. And he experienced everything that we have, all the trials and temptations and hurts and pains, weeping and grieving at the tomb of Lazarus. And even in the Garden of Gethsemane, it said that he sweat drops of blood just from the sheer stress of knowing what he had to do. So Jesus said, look, the spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak. To be afraid, depressed, sad, or grieving does not indicate a lack of faith. It's just the human response when life happens. And it's okay. He has the answers, but he's still afraid, and the memories of what happened to the northern kingdom is still fresh. He saw what happened. The Assyrians came and obliterated them. And now Babylon's coming for the southern kingdom, for Judah. To give you an idea of it, think of how we feel about the American Civil War. It's in the past, 150 years in the past, but we're still feeling the effects of it today. It's still fresh in his mind. And so knowing what happened in the north, he's scared. He's frightened. But what is his response to this? He says, though the fig tree should not bloom, blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. His response is worship. His response is worship. Even when things are falling apart around him, he says, I will praise the Lord. Courage is not the lack of fear. Courage is acting in the midst of fear. Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael in the fiery furnace, they said, we believe God can deliver us, but even if he doesn't, I will not bow to your idol. The even if, moving on from what you don't know to what you do know about God, resting on who God is. One of my favorite Christian artists is Michael Card. I love his work. It's very deep. And he wrote a song about Job. And in it, he says, yet through it all, through the tears and pain, he worshiped his God, found no reason to blame. I know my advocate watches on high. My witness in heaven sees the tears that I cry. What did Job say? Though he slay me, yet I will still trust in him. The joy does not come from yourself. It doesn't come from your circumstances. Joy comes from the God of his salvation. And in the last verse, Habakkuk says here, he makes our feet like the deer on high places. He's going, as we worship the Lord, he's going to make us sure-footed. We don't have to worry about slipping. He's going to hold us up, and he's going to bring us into those high places, into the presence of God. And so Habakkuk, he acknowledges God's plan, and he gives up his own. And we see in retrospect how that worked out, right? Babylon comes, takes Israel, takes Judah captive, and purges them of their idolatry. Then he brings in Persia to judge Babylon and to restore Judah. Restore the Israelites back to their land. And then he brings in Alexander the Great and the Greeks, providing a language of commerce so that communication can be carried out among multiple peoples of multiple nations. And then brings in Rome, who provides some, for lack of a better word of saying, some political stability, some means of transportation and infrastructure, so the message can go out to the world. God had it all planned out. He had it all laid out. And so he acknowledges God's plan, gives up on his own, and says, God, do your work. And then he rests upon what he knows and who he knows. And even though he has answers, even though his theology is correct, he's still afraid, but he responds in worship. And this is what it means for the righteous to live by faith. When I don't have all the answers, even when I do have answers, and I'm still afraid, and I'm still sad, and I'm still depressed, I know that I can trust in God, and I can enter into worship. And when I enter into worship, I get a vision of God in all of his glories, and all else fades. Let thy circumstances, let my self, let my feelings of inadequacy, my feelings of fear, my feelings of depression, be consumed by the presence of God. Psalm 91:3, he shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou find refuge. So let's go ahead and have the worship team come up and lead us into worship of the Lord.